It is Wednesday, March 19th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we head out on the campaign trail with GOP gubernatorial candidate Asa Hutchinson. Plus, an update on SWEPCO's plan to construct a major new transmission line across Northwest Arkansas.
Also, in the latest installment of our Spaces series, we go inside a car's engine. Two engines, actually. We'll see inside the engine of a 1968 Camaro and a 2014 Camaro. And we'll talk to the author of Man Alive, who's in town for a reading and signing at Nightbird Books.
Those stories and more. But first, the Arkansas legislature is set to sine die today, formally ending the fiscal session that began in February. But one key item remains for lawmakers to consider. Governor Mike Beebe issued a veto Monday on a provision granting a sales tax break for sand used in drilling natural gas and oil wells. Supporters argue the tax break is a clarification of a law exempting equipment used in manufacturing. Beebe has said the exemption, inserted in the special language subcommittee, should have been brought up under rules of the fiscal session requiring a supermajority to even entertain the measure. But Republican Representative Andy Davis, who represents parts of western Pulaski County, says otherwise.
I think that could be that's in line with other things that have been done in special language. I mean, special language can be used to clarify the legislative intent of some appropriation, you know, and how money should be collected or spent. So I think it's in line.
Davis is on the committee that passed the provision, and he suggests that further action might be beneficial.
I support the exemption in general, and I support the use of special language to do this. You know, all special language expires with the appropriation, so this can be addressed in the regular session through, you know, separate legislation, and then the special language would expire in the future.
He predicts that members will successfully override the veto. The exemption is projected to cost the state about $5 million annually.
During a four-hour meeting last night, Fayetteville aldermen gave the final votes on a number of long-considered items. One of those items was the final approval to revised mobile vendor regulations, which has been under consideration for at least the past 6 months. The new rules allow for mobile vendors to operate in more public areas and also clarify the process for obtaining permits for sites that have spaces for multiple vendors. Cynthia Morris is the owner of one of those vendor courts, the Yacht Club on College. She thanked aldermen last night for their work on enacting the changes to the city's mobile vending ordinance.
We've had so many people come through the Yacht Club and start businesses from scratch. As you come out of a recession, many people are trying to start their own business. And this has been very important to about six different businesses that have started there and have moved on to brick and mortar in our town. Thank you so much. You've put so much time and effort into helping work this out. It shows that we're a city that understands what's going on, and I really appreciate it.
Aldermen voted unanimously to approve the ordinance. The council also held a final vote on changes to the city's rules regarding urban agriculture. The ordinance is a change to four areas of city code and allows city residents to keep a certain number of goats, chickens, and bees, and allows residents to sell agricultural products from their homes. Adrian Schoenfield, director of Feed Fayetteville, argued that allowing more agriculture in the city will help fight the problem of food insecurity.
As I was walking out of the office today at the food hub, one of the neighbors brought up 3 dozen eggs to us from his backyard. So that will feed people right there, our neighbors feeding neighbors. Council Member Tennant, I think the last meeting you said that this won't really have much effect on food security in our community. I'd beg to differ. For a family who only receives $127 a month in food stamp benefits, 3 dozen eggs at $4 a dozen or $5 a dozen, depending on where you're getting them, $12 to $15 will go significant to help feed a family in our neighborhood.
Aldermen voted 6-2 in favor of the urban agriculture ordinance, with Alderman Tennant and Schopmeyer voting against.
Fort Smith city leaders last night elected to spend more than $2 million on a water infrastructure project for the Chaffee Crossing area. City directors voted unanimously to accept the bid by Preload Incorporated to build a 2.5 million gallon reservoir to provide an adequate water supply to support growth in the Chaffee Crossing and Southeast Fort Smith area. The reservoir will be fed by two water infrastructure projects currently under construction, and the project will be paid for using funds from the 2012 sales tax and use bonds issued for water transmission system improvements.
Hospitality tax collections were up for January in the River Valley. According to the CityWire, Van Buren collected $33,253 in hospitality tax for the month, a 3.6% increase over collections from the previous January. Collections in Fort Smith were also significantly higher in the first month of 2014. Fort Smith collected $56,025 of hospitality tax during the month, a 13% increase over January 2012. Much of the increase in Fort Smith is attributed to a multi-state volleyball tournament and a Baldor corporate meeting held in the city.
The New York Times deputy national editor will speak on the University of Arkansas campus next month. Peter Applebaum, who has been with the Times in various roles since 1987, will be this year's Roy Reed lecturer. The lecture will take place at 7 p.m. April 9th at the Janelle Hembree Alumni House. The lecture is free and open to the public.
The Razorback baseball team returned to Baum Stadium yesterday. Arkansas defeated Grambling State with a final score of 4-3. The win puts the Razorbacks at 10-7 on the season, and the two-game series concludes today.
Clear tonight with lows from 27 in northwest Arkansas to 33 in the Arkansas River Valley. Sunny tomorrow with highs around 70. And tomorrow night, expect clear skies with lows from 39 to 42. This is Ozarks at Large. GOP gubernatorial candidate Asa Hutchinson is a former congressman, federal prosecutor, and deputy director of Homeland Security in the post-9/11 era. Asa Hutchinson is a known commodity in Arkansas politics, having run for statewide office three times, most recently in 2006 for governor. He's the frontrunner for the GOP nomination this year, and to some, he may be the frontrunner to win the general election. He has his supporters. He has his detractors. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently spent some time with him on the campaign trail to get a feel for how Asa is playing in Arkansas.
Politicians, they shake hands, work the crowds, and ask for votes at events like this Razorback Booster Club in Saline County. They even kiss babies, or at least high-five them.
All right, go on.
Asa Hutchinson is making his second run for Arkansas governor, having lost in 2006 to term-limited Governor Mike Beebe. Hutchinson is the perceived Republican frontrunner, though he faces a challenge from Tea Party favorite Curtis Coleman, a former businessman and church choir director from North Little Rock.
Well, first of all, Asa Hutchinson, thank you for sitting down with us. Let's begin with, you got a primary opponent, Curtis Coleman, your only challenger in the Republican Party primary. Do you feel like there's a danger that if you don't overperform in the primary, that there's going to be this tag that there's an enthusiasm gap for the Republican nominee? And I'm assuming that you're going to win because I think you're the front runner at this time.
Well, one, we're not taking the Republican primary for granted. We're campaigning very hard with our county organizations, even with the Tea Party is an important element of the vote in the Republican primary. So we're going to all of these venues, competing hard, not taking it for granted. You know, in terms of expectations, I just want to win the primary, and I think that's all people look at. Whenever, you know, my opponent's been out there for probably 2 years before I ever got out there. He's been campaigning, and so a well-known figure in Republican circles. And so we're taking it very seriously, and we're just going to campaign extraordinarily hard.
50% plus one is going to be okay with you.
That's what I consider a victory and will give us momentum going into November.
Last week, Hutchinson and the probable Democratic nominee, Mike Ross, had one of their more heated campaign exchanges so far. Ross received the endorsement of the largest teachers union in the state, the Arkansas Education Association. A spokesman for Hutchinson quickly shot down the endorsement and called Ross part of a liberal agenda from a left-leaning organization.
The Arkansas Education Association endorsed Mike Ross in the governor's race. One of your spokesmen said that in this case, he's joined with the National Teachers Union, who put their liberal ideas ahead of our kids. Do you stand by that statement? Because you got some criticism from the Ross campaign for not disavowing that statement.
Well, of course, we're not disavowing the statement. Whenever you look at the NEA, the National Teachers Organization, the National Union, they have supported Obamacare. They've been advocates of the Democrat majority in Congress, including Mike Ross. They've been team players. So, of course, we're not surprised that the union would endorse Mike Ross. Now, Mike Ross tries to equate the union with all the teachers in Arkansas, and of course, that's wrong. We have tremendous support among the teachers, and my sister's was a public school teacher. My kids graduated from the public schools, so I'm an advocate for teachers. They're going to be the solution to education problems in Arkansas. The unions is somebody that we know is on the Democrat side. It's going to be endorsing Mike Ross, and he has had union support all the time that he's been in Congress.
You interviewed with the AEA, though, didn't you?
Well, I met with them, and that's just like the AFL-CIO. Okay. The AFL-CIO is going to endorse Mike Ross. They haven't announced that yet, but they're going to. But if they invite me to meet with them, then I'm happy to do so. And it's the same thing with the AEA. I believe in meeting with political adversaries because you learn from them. They're part of the political operations in Arkansas. So absolutely, I'll meet with them. Just didn't expect their endorsement. Didn't seek it.
Hutchinson has proposed more computer science teaching in public schools as a way to boost job prospects for the future. He's also advocated a middle-class tax cut, but says totally eliminating the income tax is likely unrealistic. He has, however, come around to a stronger position on the private option, the controversial health insurance program that has divided Republicans, who had a hand in crafting it with Democratic Governor Mike Beebe.
Now the dust is settled. We know that they have funded the private option. We know that there's not any short-term budgetary impacts on it. And so in 2015, just like Kim Hammer said, who changed his vote from a no to a yes, he said, now we're going to see if it works. And so I view this as a pilot project. In fact, it'll be a smaller pilot project with the limitations on the marketing aspect of it. And a pilot project is right because we're going to see what's the long-term cost. We're going to be able to get an idea on the insurance premiums and whether they fix with their predictions. We're going to see the benefit to the rural hospitals. And so at that time, then we'll be able to make a decision, is this the right path for the future? And so those are all the criteria that I will evaluate in 2015. Long-term cost, benefits that we're getting, and also I would say that you can expect from me continued efforts at reform. The private option was a start. The whole design is reform. You can expect more reform of the private option and our health care policy in Arkansas to make it unique to this state, make it work for this state. And a key criteria for me is I want incentives for people to work and not incentives for people not to work. And I want to make sure that all of the benefits of this state are that enticing for people to say, hey, I'm going to be better off by working.
Tell me a little bit about some potential reform ideas that you may have in your mind for the private option. I've talked to a number of legislators who talk about health savings accounts being more instituted, co-pays. I have talked to some legislators who don't like the amendments that were put on to restrict the navigators and the promotion of the program. What do you have in mind for potential changes, potential reforms?
Well, in terms of the health savings accounts, that's another thing we're waiting on for the federal government to grant the waiver to see if that can be implemented in Arkansas, which is a key waiver. And I'm actually hopeful because I believe in health savings accounts. I actually have one myself. I'm a little skeptical as to whether those that qualify for the private option will move that direction because it takes some money and some effort to do that.
But, and is it complicated as well, or is it?
It's not that complicated, but it takes some guidance and to get it done. But also it takes cash. I mean, you're looking at private option for those that are on marginal incomes or are not high income individuals, and so their cash flow is strained. You have to have a cash flow capability to put a health savings account into place. So let's look at that. Let's see if it works, if they grant the waiver. Obviously, that's a good reform to look at.
But for now, you're supportive of the private option as the policy of the state of Arkansas because it is the law of the land and it has been funded.
Oh, sure. It's the law, and our legislature, by 2/3 or 3/4 vote, approved it, and so the debate has ended for now. But the debate will continue, and so I support the pilot project that you see in place now, and we want to see how it works. And I will evaluate it just like all the other legislators will in terms of what's the long-term cost impact and what's the benefit we're getting from this state, and does it promote work and encouragement to work in our society.
That was Roby Brock talking to GOP gubernatorial candidate Asa Hutchinson. Roby will be traveling with Democrat candidate Mike Ross, as well as with gubernatorial challengers Curtis Coleman and Lynette Bryant in the weeks to come. For more, you can visit talkbusiness.net. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity, backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. I've got some new music from Tommy Castro and the Painkillers and Dave Keys. Also, Billy Branch, Gina Cecilia, Andy Cohen, Big George Jackson, and more. Again, that's the Generic Blue Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
Last week, a federal judge in Little Rock struck down much of the Arkansas Human Heartbeat Protection Act. People on both sides of the abortion debate aren't entirely pleased with the outcome, including members of the ACLU.
The ACLU's position is for choice, you know, freedom of choice for women to have an abortion, that it's a decision that the government should not be involved in. Second of all, the 12-week ban is clearly unconstitutional under a long line of cases starting with Roe v. Wade. No question that it's unconstitutional. And, those are the reasons we were against it.
That story is coming up in about 7 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
Southwestern Electric Power Company has filed a petition asking the Arkansas Public Service Commission to reconsider a route it's chosen for construction of a major new transmission line across northwest Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
A year ago, Southwestern Electric Power Company filed an application with the Arkansas Public Service Commission to build a new $130 million extra high voltage transmission line from Benton County Shipe Road Power Station to a proposed new substation constructed on the Kings River in Carroll County. Six routes were proposed. Public comment hearings were held in July, followed by a week-long evidentiary hearing in August. An APSC administrative law judge decided on an extreme northern route, which was confirmed by the commission February 16th. But late last week, SWEPCO filed a petition asking the State Power Service Commission permission to build the transmission line along SWEPCO's preferred route, number 33, a bit further south through Pea Ridge and around Eureka Springs. SWEPCO Fayetteville spokesperson Peter Main.
The Arkansas Public Service Commission has seven specific routing criteria, and routing transmission lines involves a balancing of many different interests. And when you rank these different routes and taking into consideration those criteria, Route 33 is the most direct route and ranks very high.
SWEPCO seeks a certificate of environmental compatibility and public need to build the transmission line.
The Southwest Power Pool, which is charged with the reliable transmission system for the region, identified future overloads on the transmission system serving North Arkansas and South Missouri. Principal overloads are in the 161 kV area and 161,000 volt system. Those identified in the study are most prominently in eastern Benton and Carroll County.
In its March 14th filing, SWEPCO's requested a limited hearing to consider a slight change to move a portion of Route 33 to just outside the boundary of some Pea Ridge National Military Park property, which it had originally crossed. Last December, the National Park Service filed a letter of complaint stating historic park property had been placed at risk by Route 33. But all six proposed routes have been met with historic opposition from thousands of residents, environmental organizations, municipalities, state and federal agencies concerned about economic and environmental impacts. Doug Stowe is a board member of Save the Ozarks, a citizens group based in Carroll County fighting the project. STO claims the project has been fast-tracked using boilerplate environmental review, so STO has requested a full rehearing.
In our case, there's probably very likely that they will it's very likely that they will refuse our request for a broad-based rehearing because they're very used to giving SWEPCO whatever they want. So we'll be going to the State Court of Appeals, but we have to go through this step first, which is required before we apply to the State Court of Appeals.
Doug Stowe says the transmission line will create a swath as wide as a football field, 700 football fields long, across sensitive Ozarks karst terrain, just so SWEPCO and associated utilities can transport Oklahoma and Arkansas-generated electricity to the eastern U.S. markets. The designated northern route's been met with opposition in Missouri, where it crosses the state border, with four legislative bills in play to block it. SWEPCO says the project's being pushed by Southwest Power Pool, headquartered in Little Rock. The nonprofit regional transmission organization, however, is governed by member electrical cooperatives, independent power producers, energy marketers, investor-owned power corporations, including SWEPCO, as well as independent transmission companies across nine states. In Southwest, Power Pool serves the Eastern Interconnection Grid, part of the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, designed to ensure the adequacy of bulk power transmission in the United States. The Arkansas Public Service Commission has 30 days to respond to SWEPCO's request. Construction of the Shipes Road-Kings River transmission line was set to begin March 2015, with a completion date set for June 2016. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Wednesday, March 19th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grahita.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Want to guess Wednesday's theme?
Does it start with a W?
No.
Okay.
Not unless we say it really badly.
Oh, well, then I have no idea.
Art.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's no way to really do that. But there's some cool things going on. Small Works on Paper, coordinated by the Arkansas Arts Council and featuring Fayetteville artists Cindy Arcega, J.P. Bell, Joanne Jones, Cindy Wiseman, and Dan Snow of Springdale, is on show at Mullins Library at the University of Arkansas through March 30th, and that is free. There is an art talk from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock Thursday at Crystal Bridges Museum with Manuela Well-Offman talking about Modernist Styles 101. A primer, as it were. Valentine's The Art of Romance is still on show at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum. About 100 Valentine's Day greeting cards. I was fascinated to talk to the exhibit service that coordinated that exhibit and some of the interesting things they found out about Valentine's that you too can find out for free. And Scenes of Newton County, a photo exhibit, is on display through May 10th at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale.
That sounds cool. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Last week, a federal judge in Little Rock struck down much of a new law enacted last year, titled the Arkansas Human Heartbeat Protection Act. That law prevented licensed doctors from performing an abortion in most cases after 12 weeks of pregnancy. While last week's order from the federal bench struck down much of the law as unconstitutional, some on both sides of the abortion debate aren't entirely pleased with the outcome. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis explains.
At the heart of the complaint brought by Lewis Edwards, a Little Rock obstetrician and gynecologist, is the idea that the 12-week ban on abortions is unconstitutional. The American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Reproductive Rights helped challenge the law, and Bettina Brownstein is a cooperating attorney with the ACLU of Arkansas.
The ACLU's position is for choice, you know, freedom of choice for women to have an abortion. That it's a decision that the government should not be involved in. Second of all, the 12-week ban is clearly unconstitutional under a long line of cases starting with Roe v. Wade. No question that it's unconstitutional. And, those are the reasons we were against it.
But as Jerry Cox, president of the Arkansas Family Council and a publicly avowed supporter of the pro-life movement, noted, Judge Weber didn't strike down all of the provisions in the law.
The judge did look at some other provisions in the bill that require the abortion doctor to do an ultrasound, that requires the abortion doctor to tell the woman that the baby has a heartbeat, and to do this in writing, and to estimate the gestational age of the unborn child and tell the woman the likelihood of that child surviving to term and being born healthy. And so it does require some informed consent.
Still yet, Bettina Brownstein of the ACLU says that Judge Weber's ruling took the teeth out of the law.
The main thrust of the law was overturned, the ban, which is by far the most important aspect of this legislation, and was the clear intent of the sponsors was to ban abortion after 12 weeks.
But that doesn't mean that Brownstein or other pro-choice supporters are completely pleased with the ruling that left parts of the Heartbeat Protection Act intact.
It's another burden. The government is mandating how medicine is practiced. I don't understand why people think the government should be involved in medical decisions between a doctor and a patient, for the doctor to make the, you know, the appropriate choice in the best medical interests of the patient.
Yet Jerry Cox of the Arkansas Family Council counters that the government got itself into the debate over abortion.
The government landed squarely in the middle of abortion in 1973 when the court passed the Roe v. Wade decision and when the court passed the Doe v. Bolton decision. Up to that point, every state was free to make its own abortion laws. It had been that way ever since the country was founded. And the court decided to jump right in the middle of that when they passed those rulings back in 1973, and they've been in the middle of it ever since.
However, Bettina Brownstein says that passing laws like the Heartbeat Protection Act that run counter to Roe versus Wade is a futile effort.
They're just costing the state needless expense, and because certainly we seek attorney fees and goes into the coffers of the ACLU. Needless expense, it's a useless exercise.
She says that she's not yet sure what the next course of action in the case will be.
If the state appeals, it's possible we will cross appeal on the provisions that were allowed to stand. At this point, it's too early to say.
Meanwhile, Jerry Cox says that while an appeal by the state's attorney general would be one possible course of action, another lies in looking at the guidance issued in Judge Weber's ruling and taking those lessons forward into new legislation.
The legislature will be in session in January of next year, and there will be an opportunity for lawmakers to pass some legislation that hopefully will help women make the better choice. Decide not to abort their baby, decide to put the baby up for adoption or keep the baby. And there are bills that can be drafted and put forth that will help women with that crisis pregnancy.
He pointed to laws passed in Texas and Louisiana that are centered on the notion of requiring informed consent before an abortion is performed, and although the remaining portion of Arkansas's Heartbeat Protection Act accomplishes the informed consent to some degree, Cox said he believes the state could go further with more legislation. But whether legislators agree will be up to the next General Assembly, to be elected this fall and set to convene in roughly 10 months' time. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
The lively concerto by Richard Prue, festival improvisations, talented young artists, and an organ and piano duet that keeps it all in the family. Enjoy some unique recital performances from an American Guild of Organists gathering and share in the conventional wisdom, a Chicago collection. This week on Pipe Dreams from American Public Media, I'm Michael Barone. I hope you'll be listening.
Pipe Dreams begins this Sunday at 9 p.m. on 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's never too early to start thinking about the weekend. I know a lot of people say Thursday is the new Friday. And with spring break on the horizon, there are a number of entertainment options scheduled for the upcoming days. Northwest Arkansas Community College's Department of Music will present Antonella Gazzoli, a soprano from Tuscany, Italy, in a vocal recital at 7 p.m. tomorrow. The recital will be held in the Walmart Auditorium of NWAC's Shoemaker Center for Workforce Technologies. Gazzoli will be accompanied by pianist Lyndon Meyer of Tulsa. She will sing works by Mozart, Schubert, Strauss, and Puccini. The event is free and open to the public. She will also be performing at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art's Vivaldi's Sounds of Spring at 7 p.m. Friday in the Great Hall. For more information, email milesfish@mac.com.
The auditorium in Eureka Springs will host a concert and dance event Friday, celebrating the beginning of spring. Growers from local plant nurseries and farms have donated seedlings and spring bedding plants available for a nominal donation at the event. Attendees can take home their own living symbol of spring as a memento and as a way to pay it forward. All money raised at the door and from the plant sale will be donated to Arco Iris Earth Care Project. The Spring Equinox concert is scheduled for 7 p.m. Friday at the Odd. Admission is $5 for adults and $2 for kids at the door. For more information, email fiddlinfred51@gmail.com.
And let's go fly a kite. Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge will host its 24th annual Kite Festival celebration Saturday. Art with an Altitude, sponsored by Kaleido Kites of Eureka Springs, is a free family event inviting attendees to bring their own kites or buy one at the refuge. The celebration includes vendors, contests, and fun activities for parents and children. Local band Brick Fields is scheduled to perform at the event. Kaleido Kites experts will be available to assist children in kite making and flying techniques. Donations to the refuge are requested for kite making assistance. Kaleido Kites will donate a Japanese Rokeku fighting kite and a lion kite for an on-site raffle, and proceeds will benefit Turpentine Creek. Admission is free for kite flying, and regular admission prices apply to tour refuge wildlife on display. Proceeds finance rescue and ongoing care for more than 120 tigers, lions, cougars, and other wildlife that make the sanctuary a lifelong home. For additional information, contact Kaleido Kites at 253-6596. For details on Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge, visit www.turpentinecreek.org.
Hobbs State Park is one of several organizations hosting spring break activities. The first of several Nature Exploration Day camps at the park for 2014 runs from March 26th through the 28th. This day camp is for nature lovers 9 to 12 years of age with a passion for hiking and spending time outside exploring and learning. Hiking, games, live animals, nature-related programs, crafts, snacks, stream studies, a t-shirt, and more are included. The day camp runs from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day. The cost is $50 plus tax per child. Pre-registration and prepayment are required. For more, call 789-5000.
Arts Live Theater is now enrolling students for their spring break camps. These include a Create a Play Together camp for kids 5 to 8 years old, and a musical theater camp for kids 9 to 12. For more information, artslivetheater.com.
There are a few athletic games at area colleges and universities this week. The John Brown University women's basketball team is competing in the NAIA National Championship Tournament in Frankfort, Kentucky. JBU will face Lyon College in a first-round game tomorrow night at 7. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith Lions baseball team hosts the University of Texas Permian Basin Friday afternoon at 1. The University of the Ozarks softball team opens a three-game series against Mississippi College with a 3 o'clock game Friday afternoon in Clarksville.
The Arkansas women's tennis team hosts Mississippi in Fayetteville Friday afternoon at 1. And the number 15 U of A gymnastics team will compete in Session 1 of the 2014 Southeastern Conference Championship as the number 6 seed on Saturday in Birmingham, Alabama. Session 1 is slated for a 2:05 p.m. start. After the SEC championship, the Razorbacks will continue postseason action by hosting the 2014 NCAA Fayetteville Regional in Barnhill Arena on April 5th. Listen, can you tell the difference between this? And this? Would you believe me if I told you the difference was 46 years? The first was a 1968 Camaro. The second, a 2014 car of the same make. Both sit in the large garage at Arkansas Collision Center on Randall Wobey Lane in Springdale. For this month's visit to an interesting space, Jim Hunter, owner of ACC, takes us under the hoods of an older and a newer vehicle.
For the most part, you look under an engine anymore and it's going to be covered with a complete shield. This particular car does not have a shield, but it's got a lot of things covered. You don't see the spark plug. What's very nice, these cars will last a long time if you maintain them.
Oil changes are important to maintaining the life of an engine, especially with today's engines. They last 200,000 miles to 250,000 miles. Jim says the oil should be changed the typical 3,000 to 5,000 miles. More and more, it's 5,000 miles in today's cars, thanks to newer oils. And under the engine of a new car?
Obviously, you have the maintenance, which is air filters. There's also a cabin air filter, which filters out the outside air. If those things get plugged up or don't get changed, then you could find out that your heating and air conditioning isn't working at the maximum, you know, making maximum air or heat. You even find out, you might even think your air conditioning's not working, which we've had that happen before. When we just change the filter, it produces enough air to cool or heat your car accordingly.
In my newer 2012 car, I tend to rely on warning lights and dealer computer printouts to tell me if something needs to be taken care of, or if something is wrong with my car. Even when my oil needs to be changed, there's really no need for the stickers on the inside of a windshield or a small notepad in the glove box. Jim says new cars are pretty much idiot-proof.
You know, you could almost run them out of oil and the computer would say it's out of oil, shut it off, let's not burn up the engine.
He says many car people complain that you can't work on the new ones anymore because things are so high-tech and hard to get to. On older cars, like the 68 Camaro, things are easily accessible. And there is definitely less going on under the hood of the 46-year-old car.
You can see the spark plug wires, very easily accessed. Obviously, no computers on this one. And so you have the lights that says low oil, low coolant or antifreeze. Or you really won't even say that, just say it's getting hot.
Back in the day, the engines probably had a 12-month, 12,000-mile warranty. Today, a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty is not unheard of. The lack of computers and the fact that everything is manual keeps the crampedness under the hood to a minimum.
No computers, no, everything's very manual. Manual brakes, no anti-lock brakes. Some of them are even drum brakes or take a lot longer to stop.
He says things have really changed over the last 40 plus years. But those from the old school like the old stuff. If comfort is a concern, new is the way to go. as this is a body shop. The already restored 1968 Camaro is here for some work of that nature. It has some rust spots. The old-style metal has a tendency to rust more quickly. Newer cars are made with galvanized, pre-dipped metals. But because of that and the type of designs, parts are more often replaced. Off-center a bit, inside the cavernous garage, is a paint booth. Not sure if that is the technical term, but that's what I dubbed it. Inside the paint booth, a worker has donned a mask that looks like it was stolen from the movie Outbreak. In his hand is a paint sprayer. The large white box, big enough for the largest of today's SUVs, is environmentally controlled, complete with a loud fan system on top.
Everything is filtered and exhausted per OSHA and per EPA. We also have a 1.2 million BTU furnace, so everything is then baked, similar to the factory. The factory bakes probably around 400 degrees. We bake at about 175. We can't bake it any higher because we'll probably have a meltdown of all the plastic pieces.
Baking speeds up the drying process by activating a hardener. If that 68 Camaro had its original paint, Jim says it would still be drying, as solvents would be leaving the paint. That's the way old paint dried. A back room at ACC is the repair facility, complete with a frame machine that can realign a car's frame to within a millimeter of a factory specification. Here, a couple of workers are busy on a variety of vehicles, one of which is a hybrid, a relatively new advent of the last 15 years, and something that Jim says they have to watch out for.
For us, it's important that you disconnect everything because these hybrids with the batteries, I've heard of people doing work on these, doing paintless dent repair where you use rods to push out dents. And where when somebody was electrocuted and it killed them using these. So again, proper shutdown of all these vehicles. Same with everything we do. We have to disconnect computers accordingly.
Jim credits 40 years in the business to word of mouth and says the best way to find a good body shop or mechanic is to listen to others' feedback. But he does agree that finding a trustworthy mechanic can be difficult.
It's always a challenge, you know, finding a good mechanic who's going to be honest, who's going to charge for what they do and do what they charge for. I think that's what anybody wants. And I think to go to a mechanic, ask questions, find out what they're going to do, and get some options. What are my options? It's not always, you may need to have this and this done, but do you need to have it done right now? So I think a shop that gives you enough information, that gives you the opportunity to make a reasonable, to make a choice.
Jim has been in the body shop business for almost as many years as the 68 Camaro is old. He sees vehicles for a variety of reasons, recently because of winter weather. But he says summer is their busiest time, because accidents tend to happen when more people are on the roads. As accidents do happen, if one happens to you, call 479-750-4222. You'll either reach Jim or his wife, Dodie. This is Ozarks at Large.
That many of us share, that a single instant can change everything. In the novel Man Alive, the life-altering moment is just 4 pages in, a lightning strike that sends a doctor into the street and leaves him wanting to end his practice and spend his days at the barbecue grill. The author of Man Alive is on the University of Arkansas campus this week, and tonight she'll read at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums caught up with her last evening and has this report.
Mary Kay Zaravilov says she had an unusual task in just the first few pages of her novel, Man Alive. The book's last 280 pages document a family coping with a father who, after he's struck by lightning, decides he wants to change his life, move on. So she brings the lightning bolt early.
Right away. And one of the big challenges was, you have to know who he is before the lightning strike, even though the lightning hits him on page 4.
So we learn about the person Dr. Owen Lerner was before that jolt of electricity by meeting him on the last day of his 3-week summer vacation. It's a time to eat fried foods and unwind a bit.
But also to catch up on his medical journal. So he's still a little bit of the doctor, but he's right on that cusp. And because it's that last day, you have that list in your head. I have to return this phone call and I'll have to do this with this patient. And so he is beginning to start that list of all the things that are going to have to be taken care of.
After the lightning strike, Dr. Owen Lerner, through his recovery, decides he might want to change things, his day-to-day life. That means shedding occupation and perhaps family. Suddenly, the symptoms he's been treating in his young patients, symptoms like attention deficit disorder, post-traumatic stress, impulsive behavior, and children on the autism spectrum, are symptoms he's dealing with himself. Mary Kay says the seed for her novel began in a magazine article written by Oliver Sacks.
About lightning strike of a surgeon who heard piano music. And he had played piano as a kid, if I remember this correctly, but just that, just piano lessons, the obligatory piano lessons. So now he really became devoted to it, and he took composition because he wanted to record what he heard, not during the lightning strike in this Oliver Sacks world, but afterwards, he was visited by these piano compositions. And so that guy actually did leave his life, left his wife, and became a piano composer. So in my world, I just put that article aside because I liked it. I had used that metaphor as writing to say it took me a long time as a writer to get down the music I heard in my head. So that's why I liked that article. But then as I put the article aside, I had that full-blown thought of, okay, pediatric psychopharmacologist struck by lightning. Say it with me now. And all he wants to do is barbecue. So I wrote the scene of him being struck by lightning because I needed it to be somewhat ecstatic, almost religious, and then started the research to see how injured he would be because I had to follow him through pages. So could he pick up a cup? Could he go downstairs? Could he sit in a chair? Could he put his pants on? And so the research was really about the level of injury. And he has these marks down his arm. They're called lightning flowers or Lichtenberg figures that some people get when they're struck by lightning. So how long do they last and do they hurt? And that was necessary. Really, I was just beginning to follow him where he loses faith in what he had been practicing. And he begins to say, what is normal? What is normal? They're in a really competitive slice of society. And he's treating these kids. He's giving them drugs so they will, in fact, behave normally. And that has its own controversy. And he's had some great success. So he's sort of rethinking all of that.
With that examination of his profession and his life, the relationships between Owen and his wife, Toni, and their 3 children begin to come under severe strain. Mary Kay Zarafilov takes us into each of the 5 characters' heads to let us see and hear what they're thinking, often thoughts or experiences they're not sharing with the rest of their family. While often funny and kind, the book also takes us very close to each of the characters, closer than we might want to get initially.
You don't know what a compliment that is, because it's hard to not, it's easier to look away.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal was to not look away. So I'm not glad I made you squirm, but that intimacy was a real goal for this book. And how do you do that? I mean, one of the devices that became necessary was to tell the book through what I called family point of view. So you're hearing about each of them through their point of view. Nobody outside the family's observations are essential, but each person, when they are narrating something, it's their story. And I was just talking to a student just before I came about this, that for me, this was a great revelation. It's nothing big for a lot of other people, but that is how little of our personal narratives we are sharing one to another. So each of these people are spinning, well, they're each spinning out of control because of what has happened to Owen, and they're each spinning the story out, but no matter how close they are, they're not sharing it. And I found that is such a simple truth, but I found it very devastating as I wrote the book.
The book has earned readers, and it's earned praise. The Washington Post named Man Alive a notable fiction book of 2013. With its growing popularity, Mary Kay has had the opportunity to talk about the novel with book clubs, college students, and recently high school classes.
This has been really interesting for me. And so I'll say, does Owen owe this family anything? The boys are in college. The daughter's 16. He's been married a long time. And so he wants to be a different person. You know, what is that their business is his take on it. And the students will first say, high school students will say, no, he should be able to do whatever he wants now. So that's kind of their concept of being an adult, that they'll finally get to do what they want. And also they'll say, those boys are in good schools and he's done all this. He has a beach house. And then I will take them down that path. Okay, so one of your parents says, that's enough.
I'm out.
Yeah, and then we'll start talking about it. And you can see the fear start to cloud their eyes. And they'll say, okay, maybe he can't just walk away. But, and so we'll really examine that.
Mary Kay Zarafalov has been talking to students on the University of Arkansas campus this week. Tonight, she'll discuss and sign copies of her book at Nightbird Books. Here's a preview.
I'm going to read, as you said, it's not giving anything away to say that he is hit by lightning early. So this is the very first chapter. The whole family is simply going out to dinner, and they've parked the car, and the kids are horsing around. So they're thinking about how long the wait will be in the restaurant, and he is putting quarters in the parking meter. Owen hears a loud buzz, an intensifying hum zeroing in on him. He figures the noise for a beach plane trailing a happy hour proclamation and questions the wisdom of flying one of those two-seaters through flashing clouds. All of this is happening as he touches serrated edge of quarter to smooth slot of parking meter, the barest of contact, and he is literally blown away. His first reaction is, that parking meter packs a wallop. Of course, he can't understand inside the flash that he's being struck by lightning. It's more like stepping off the high dive and then plummeting into a hot spotlight of water. Neither inhaling nor exhaling, Owen feels heavy pressure on his ribs and within his sinuses. Both his heart and ears yearn to rupture, while his arms and legs flail spasmodically, not in a swimming groove. More like a believer shot full of God, some maniac at a revival compelled to twitch and moan in languages not yet discovered before plunging into the baptismal font. He is white hot as well as deeply quenched by the singed, syrupy fluid of his surround.
Mary Kay Zarafalov will read tonight at Nightbird Books beginning at 7:30 and sign copies of her novel, Man Alive. And about that title, a perfect use of an exclamation one might make if suddenly shocked, but also a hint at the awakening, for better or ill, that Dr. Owen Lerner experiences after the lightning strike. Mary Kay says that title did not come to her like, well, a bolt of lightning.
No, there were many other titles, Remain in Light and Parking Meter. It was Parking Meter for Meter Man. So when he comes to as after the lightning strike, he says, Man Alive. And so then I realized, oh, that has to be the title. And then there were long discussions over whether or not it should have an exclamation point. And it does.
But it's a lightning bolt.
That's a designer, which I love.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Decatur.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. We'll end today's edition of Ozarks with a song by Coyote Union. The song is Teardrop River. The band will be with Basement Brew Friday night at 9 at Light Bulb Club in Fayetteville.